Good morning, this is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, we'll be talking with Jacob Levy, Political Science Department at the University of Chicago, and our topic is multiculturalism. Jacob, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you, glad to be here.
Well, if we're going to talk about multiculturalism, perhaps you could begin by explaining exactly what you mean by the term multiculturalism.
Well, I think it's important to have some use of the word multiculturalism that just describes the fact of cultural and ethnic pluralism that is so common in modern societies. I think that a lot of the time people try to win a debate at the beginning about what policies we should pursue by loading something into the idea of multiculturalism and saying, as our societies become more multicultural, therefore they have to adopt one version or another of the person's political agenda. So when I say multiculturalism just as such, all I really mean to be talking about is the social fact. Our societies are pluralistic, our societies have speakers of many languages and believers in many religions and immigrants from many societies.
Okay, and so what you're trying to rule out is some people use the term, well, it's loaded one way or the other. Either it's a form of criticism, well, that's just being multicultural, or it's a term of praise, and you're wanting to say, that's a mistake, let's just describe it as a fact of cultural pluralism, and then we'll talk about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing or what sort of thing it is.
That's right, and how we ought to respond to it, but first we need to be able to talk in a common language about the fact that our societies look like this before we can talk about what policies should be prompted by that fact.
As it turns out, of course, and we're going to come back to talking about what it is it means to be a multicultural society, but as it turns out, people do have very strong reactions about what it means to say that a culture or the society is multicultural, and that you're inclined to think that they are the standard ways, at least, in which we evaluate and talk about it are mistaken. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that for the listener.
Well, I think that there are two very common ways to react. One is to try to make of this fact of multiculturalism, this fact of cultural pluralism, something that's intrinsically valuable and worthy of promotion and protection, such that anything that leads to, for instance, assimilation, if immigrants coming to a new society decide to adapt to the existing culture, decide to assimilate into the majority culture, then that's taken as a bad thing because it is a violation of multiculturalism, even if it is a matter of the free choices of immigrants being made. And the other is usually marked by an excessive use of the term Balkanization, talking about multiculturalism as necessarily an attack on having one society, having one government. These are in some ways the mirror images of each other. People who use the word multiculturalism as that first kind of term of praise, saying we need to protect and preserve every culture that happens to exist, really are doing what the critics on the right then accuse everyone who talks about multiculturalism of doing. But neither is something that we necessarily have to do in talking about multiculturalism. We don't have to think that the government should be in the business either of protecting or of trying to get rid of minority cultures.
All right. In your book called The Multiculturalism of Fear, which I would recommend to anyone interested in this topic, very, very interesting book, you talk about the ways in which these two opposing ideas are mistaken, and you seem to say that they're mistaken at least in part because each of them fails to understand some pretty basic facts about the nature of society, about the nature of what cultures are, about people's commitment to cultures. And I wonder if you could talk about or just identify what you see as those pretty basic facts, and then we can go on and see how this plays out for evaluating various views of multiculturalism.
There's something funny about cultural identities. They are fictitious. They are imaginary in a very strong sense. The identities of nations in particular, but more broadly the identities of ethnic groups, are almost always based on a projection and imagination of a fictive history. we pretend that all of us are unified in some important way. And something that historians do over and over again in every nation in the world today is to go back and debunk the nationalist myth, the founding myths of what it meant to be this nation, of how unified these people were generations ago. Most importantly, the myth that the people who, say, are now Czech or who are now Croat or who are now Serb somehow always were that people, instead of just being part of the broad, subtly differentiated range of Slavic peoples across Eastern Europe. But despite that fictiveness, despite the imaginary character of national identity, national and ethnic identities feel very powerful and very real to people who are in the middle of living them. And I think this is true for many of us. I can recognize how fictitious much of the mythology of what it meant to be an American was. I can recognize all of the ways in which it's just not true that I have things deeply in common with someone from southern Texas that I don't have in common with someone from Nova Scotia. And yet, we feel it very powerfully. It's very hard not to live our lives as if it really mattered and we really were unified with fellow members of our nation or our ethnic group or our tribe or our religion. The two sets of errors that I talked about before, the desire to preserve and protect all cultures as such, and the desire to override minority cultures in some quest for national homogeneity, I think each fails to grasp one of those faces of ethnic and national identity. If you think that you can rapidly assimilate everyone into one shared majority culture, then you're failing to notice how deeply felt ethnic identity really is in every moment, even though the ethnic identity I feel deeply might not be, probably is not, the same ethnic identity that my grandparents felt deeply, though I imagine that it was. They still felt theirs deeply, I still feel mine deeply, and if I perceive an attack on it, if I perceive that the government is trying to make me give it up, then I will react strongly and negatively. On the other hand, if we try to preserve cultures, cultural traditions, like museum pieces, try to protect them in some pristine, isolated way, one from another, then we're giving in to the fictions. Then we're taking the understanding of an ethnic identity that exists at some one moment and saying, that's the real one. That's the one that we will protect for generations. When in fact, every ethnic and religious and cultural identity is very fluid over the course of generations. It changes. People decide to assimilate one matter or another into a neighboring culture. They emphasize something rather than another. They emphasize their religion over their language or the other way around. And the impulse to cultural preservation always has to try to freeze that fluidity. It always has to try to pretend that our current understanding of an ethnic identity is the real one to preserve for the generations.
Okay, there's several things there I'd like to pick up on if we could. One, for example, you said that, you know, that it is this fiction and nonetheless we feel it very importantly. Clearly one possibility that comes to mind is in lots of other circumstances, if people believe fictions and believe them to be true and are willing to kill to preserve them, we see that as a sign of some kind of psychological illness, and what we do is we encourage them to go get help. Why is that not the appropriate response here?
There are urges at different levels here. Some are very old and some are very new. I think the urge to love home and hearth, love the territory that one associates with one's home, the mountains near where you were born, the ocean you were raised with, and the urge to value your kin over other people, people you perceive as members of your in-group, your kind, over the rest of the world. But those are very, very old. They are probably as close as we can come to saying that some human behavior is natural. It is natural somehow to value what's yours and the people who are like you over other people. In the modern age, though, when we no longer have the option of face-to-face tribal societies where the people who are like me are just the 30 or 50 people who live in my immediate surroundings, there are political and economic imperatives that drive us to have very large states with languages that are shared across millions of people instead of dozens of people, with languages that can be written down in a standardized form. All of those imperatives take those original emotions, the love of home and hearth, the love of kin, and extend them across this necessarily fictitious range. Because we have to have a language that's shared by millions of people, and because we're very used to thinking that language is a marker of people who are like me, the people I can understand, then I come to imagine that all those millions of people who share my written language are like me. And no matter how often we're told or we're reminded that it's not the case, no matter how often we're reminded the language we speak is a recent creation, or that its written form is a recent creation, or that my ancestors or your ancestors didn't actually speak it, it was the language of some other group at the time, we can't fully live our lives remembering those truths. The emotions that we had to begin with about affection for what's nearby, about being comfortable with what's familiar, get extended to this new broader range, this new larger scale society. And so I'm not sure what it would mean to live in a modern society, to live in the modern world, wholly cured of these psychological ailments of love for this fiction, of affection for this imaginary community. We might be able to imagine moving from one to another. We can say we will debunk this myth and this myth and this myth, but I don't know that we can live our lives without, to return to this example, just feeling more comfortable in our native language, and therefore constantly making this psychological leap to pretend that other people who share our native language share something important with us instead of sharing something merely accidental with us, which is the real truth.
All right. One other thing, and actually I think it follows nicely on that response. One of the things you said earlier is you said that if we begin to take these fictions as if they were too real, then we assume that the culture that exists now is the right one, and therefore we tend to freeze that culture for all time. And it occurred to me when you said it that it freezes it in two ways. One, it freezes it in other people's eyes, but it can also freeze it for the people who are part of the culture themselves. They may feel as if they can't change even a bit. They've got to be true to their culture.
Yeah.
Is that something, in fact, that happens?
Absolutely. It's one of the primary dangers that arises as cultures come into more and more extended contact with each other. When we recognize the possibility of cultural change, when it becomes something that happens in a time span that we can live to see instead of something that happens over the course of generations, then some members of a cultural community will react very conservatively. They'll be very insistent that the things that we feel attachment to now be preserved and protected against the possibility of change. This will then often encourage them to rule relatively tyrannically over other members of their cultural community. They will, for instance, forbid marrying outside the group and try to enforce that rule quite strictly. They will forbid socializing or trading with the other group, forbid learning the other language, forbid any of the mechanisms that seem to promote cultural shift and cultural change over time. Very often, of course, the primary burden of those rules falls onto women, partly because the conservative rules themselves that the elders are trying to enforce are rules about sexuality and marriage and childbearing, partly because as the culture gets more enmeshed in modern society and economics and in politics, the family comes to seem like the only place where the old ways can really be preserved. And so men may go out into the world and interact with the wider world on a daily basis. But women are to be kept within the community and kept within the home so that children may be raised in the old ways. And so what one often sees is that rules become harsher in moments of cultural contact. In Britain, it's now been known to be the case that Pakistani immigrants who have arranged marriages for their daughters, and in the relevant parts of Pakistani culture, arranged marriages were traditional. But in Britain now, daughters learn that they have other choices. When parents arrange a marriage, the daughter refuses. She runs away so as to get out from under what she perceives to be oppressive cultural tradition. And making fine use of modernity and tools that would not have been available to them in traditional rural Pakistan, the British parents have hired assassins. They've hired hitmen to hunt down their daughters to do away with the shame and stigma that's brought upon them by having a daughter reject the arranged marriage. The rules become harsher in this multicultural context than they were to begin with in order to try to protect cultural integrity once we can see that cultural integrity is going to slip away.
All right. You've done a very nice job, it seems to me, of pointing out what you see as some of the drawbacks of both ways in which people tend to sometimes think of multiculturalism. One, in the last third of the show, you can begin to trace out what you think is a better response, a better way to see and understand and think about the facts of cultural pluralism in the modern state. Maybe, again, you could just sort of give an overview, and then we can unpack it in the remaining third of the show.
In addition to the dangers that I just talked about, dangers of oppression within a cultural community that sharpen in moments of cultural contact, we have to be worried, constantly worried, about the dangers posed by the state and the state's own drive to assimilation, to compulsory conformity. States like to have a shared language. States like to have a shared vision of national unity projected backward on the past. And so states, one way or another, try to enforce homogeneity on their population. Whether they do so by forcing those who are different to assimilate, or by trying to get rid of them, force them to speak the common language, outlaw teaching of the ancestral language, or, on the other hand, commit ethnic cleansing, shove people outside the boundaries of the state, deny them citizenship, allow the police or the immigration authorities to detain them, to beat them, or, in extremis, commit slavery or genocide against them. So we always want to be designing policies, I think, trying to hedge against both kinds of dangers, the danger within a community and the danger from the state. Creating policies to protect against state is maybe easier conceptually, though harder politically. Such policies prominently include institutions of ethnic federalism. You give members of a minority culture, a group like the Scots in Britain or the Quebecois in Canada or the Catalans in France, you give them some political institutions that they can dominate, that they can use to protect their community against the state. Today, we don't expect that the Canadian democracy or the Spanish democracy or the British democracy is going to set about trying to outlaw the minority languages. But it's within living memory that Spain did outlaw the teaching of the Basque language or the Catalan language, and that a very violent Spanish government sent the army in to try to shut down any institutions of the minority language. Our ally, Turkey, continues to do this against the Kurdish language. Institutions of ethnic federalism, where members of the minority dominate the government of some province, they can run an educational system within that province, give them some structural protection within the state system, give them a place where they can stand against the capital in the event the capital turns violent and nationalistic and assimilationist. Some of the most vulnerable minority groups our indigenous populations. American Indians, Australian Aborigines, New Zealand's Maori, the tribal peoples in the deserts of South Africa. There are indigenous populations, non-industrial, tribally based in their organization, in their politics, who have over and over again, when they've come into contact with industrial states, with modern states, been subject to expropriation and violence on the most horrific of scales. The violence against American Indians all throughout the Americas is still, I think, under acknowledged and how extensive it was and underappreciated and how horrific it was. So long as indigenous populations want to continue to maintain their traditional lifestyles, there's constantly going to be a danger that the state is going to try to take their land, try to use their land for its own purposes, its own more industrial or commercial purposes, and to try to forcibly assimilate its people. Therefore, it's tremendously important when you have, as we do throughout the Americas, as they do in Australia and New Zealand, indigenous populations within a settler society or within some broader industrial modern state, to have institutions of customary law and customary land rights. The legal system that the British brought to North America or to Australia didn't fully recognize ownership rights in that the indigenous populations held to their land that they had occupied for centuries. Sometimes, as in North America, the British legal system did a better job of recognizing some ownership rights. Sometimes, as in Australia, it was the official legal position that the Aborigines owned none of the land on the continent, and that as soon as Britain colonized the continent, every Aborigine became a trespasser on government land. There are continuing after effects of all of those decisions and their parallel decisions in Latin America, in Taiwan, in India, in South Africa, and so on. There has been dispossession. Many indigenous people simply will never get their land back. But often, too, this continued indigenous occupation of land that isn't legally recognized as belonging to the indigenous peoples, or there is a history of broken treaties of land that is still legally that of the Indians or the Aborigines or whoever, but where the states have been unwilling to grant that land. Having strong institutions that allow tribal government in the United States, or some protection of customary legal regimes, and most importantly, customary land rights, customary property rights, is tremendously important for giving indigenous people the ability to stand against the state when the state comes to assimilate them or to take their land or to move them away.
Okay, in the last 3 minutes, I would like you to maybe address one other feature that you think would be important, and I'll at least toss one out as a possibility because I thought it was very interesting in your discussion, and that was the role of the importance of symbolic gestures made toward minority groups. But again, perhaps there's some other element that you'd prefer to talk about.
No, that's very interesting and important. Some of the things that states do don't affect anyone's rights. They don't take anyone's property, they don't take anyone's income, they don't restrict anyone's liberty. When a state adopts a flag, when a state puts a name onto a city or a park, when a state erects monuments and statues, those things don't affect any one of us individually. And so in the American discourse, where we're very used to talking about things as matters of rights, we're sometimes not sure what to say about those things. It seems to me that the symbols of the state have very often been used to celebrate histories of violence, of exclusion, of injustice against ethnic and cultural minorities. And that at the very least we can say about state symbols that even when they don't violate anyone's rights, they must not do that. They must not celebrate a history of slavery in the United States, for example. They must not be adopted so as to deliberately shut out members of religious minorities, as was the case in India when the city of Bombay changed its name to Mumbai, which had much more strongly Hindu nationalistic associations. In South Africa, it seems perfectly appropriate that the holidays and statues and other symbols of the state are being changed so as to no longer celebrate apartheid, as they did for many generations. And when naming places, when naming parks in the United States, for instance, one shouldn't adopt names that celebrate warfare against Indians or that use derogatory terms for Indians. One ought to indeed, if possible, make some move toward recognizing and accommodating Indians or the excluded minority groups. But you can't always do that. What you can always do is commit to a rule that says we will not continue to celebrate the things that were done wrong in the past. We won't celebrate slavery by putting a Confederate flag into state flags, for instance. And sometimes we will adopt a symbol, a statue, a holiday, an apology, an official government apology, that explicitly aims to reconcile with our past, that explicitly aims to repent of some of these injustices that every state has lurking in its history.
Well, I hate to say it, we are out of time. I would again like to encourage anyone who's so inclined to look up your book, purchase your book, The Multiculturalism of Fear, because you have some, lots of other very specific things to say in terms of proposals, which I think are very interesting, very meritorious. I appreciate you taking the time to appear on the show today.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking today with Jacob Levy, professor of political science at the University of Chicago. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.